From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And Jeremy, it feels like America is bracing.
Yeah, yesterday, that amazing number from Dr. Anthony Fauci, the announcement that he made that COVID-19 deaths could total 200,000 in the U.S. That is a best case scenario. President Trump told Americans to stay home, not until Easter, but now through April 30th.
And hospital workers, especially in New York, facing what's expected to be a tsunami of illness in a couple of weeks, with many already underwater. Dr. Peter Scheer is chief medical officer at Mount Sinai Hospital in Brooklyn. He wrote a dispatch in New York Magazine. And doctor, you say you're seeing 5 to 10 COVID-19 related deaths a day. You're looking at a refrigerator truck morgue parked outside your window. About 15% of your staff is out sick with the virus. 40 people waiting in the ER for a bed. Describe that.
The emergency room is just packed full of patients, just end-to-end patients. Almost all of them are COVID-19 positive. So they're sick patients with respiratory illness. The less acute patients that have COVID are being seen and discharged relatively quickly. So the ones that are in there need to be admitted, need to be hospitalized.
How's your staff? How's the morale? What does it feel like?
I would say morale is compromised. The staff that are here, obviously not the ones who are sick, they're stretched very thin. There's, you know, a feeling of helplessness, which comes from the fact that it causes a lot of severe respiratory decompensation quickly. You can't save a lot of patients.
Yeah, there's nothing you can do. And you talk about, you all made plans. You would have patients who would have those negative pressure airflow rooms and a dedicated nurse. Well, that's all gone out the window. What are you short of? Do you have beds for patients?
We need more beds for patients, and some of those are going to be coming in the form of transferring more of our patients out to our sister hospitals. We are hopeful that a large mobile hospital tent is going to be set up today, running tomorrow in Central Park, that can take some patients.
Wait, patients in Central Park in a tent?
In a tent. This is a field hospital. The company already has one running in Italy. So those being options for how to sort of manage the volume that we're seeing here. And I think Brooklyn and Queens are being harder hit than other places.
Yeah. You've had cases of, you know, married couples, both of them sick, can't see each other as one dies. You know, we're seeing some of it, but not that much, because obviously it's dangerous to go inside these hospitals. But what do you want people to know about how it looks and feels in your hospital right now?
I think in the evenings, people are opening their windows, as they did in Italy, and giving a round of applause and cheers for healthcare workers. So I think people know that the healthcare workers out there across the city are working incredibly hard, but they just need to know that they are shouldering a huge burden. And that burden is hard work at a time when they're maybe putting their own health at risk, but also that sense of hopelessness is going to linger.
You wrote, hey, I have a COVID-positive 41-year-old who just died 5 minutes ago. You say that what's ahead, yes, we have heard a lot about a shortage of ventilators, but it's not just choosing between the 30-year-old and the 80-year-old, both of whom could use a ventilator. It's deciding that there are people for whom a ventilator won't help.
And that's important as well. And I think we're recognizing an increasing role for palliative care. There are specialists who are trained in the skills of assessment and care and communication that go along with palliative care, but probably not enough of them to go around. As we identify the patients who are clearly not going to improve, we need those physicians and those physician skills to communicate with patients and family members to say, we can't cure this, but we can help support you and give you the best chance possible and continue to ensure your comfort.
That's going to be a tough conversation.
It is. I have an additional palliative care physician who is deployed out here today who's going to help me assess which patients they can most be helpful with in this regard.
Yeah. Dr. Scheer, I'm going to let you go to do your good work. But you all seem stunned. They're coming and coming, and it's not stopping. I mean,
there's a lot of volume.
Anything else you want us to know?
Just we're working as hard as we can, and that the expressions of love and support are helpful. But just know that the caregivers will need continued care after this all passes.
You say there's going to be PTSD.
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Peter Scheer, Chief Medical Officer, Brooklyn's Mount Sinai Hospital, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, Louisiana's death rate is not as high as New York's, but it is alarming. And over the weekend, a 33-year-old staffer for Governor John Bel Edwards died after contracting coronavirus. The city of New Orleans has among the highest number of cases per capita in the U.S. Joining us now is Patrick Madden, regional news director for WWNO in New Orleans and WRKF in Baton Rouge. Patrick, the state has been under a stay-at-home order since last week, but a pastor in Baton Rouge made headlines for holding services yesterday anyway. Are most people in Louisiana taking the order seriously?
Yeah, I'd say most people are taking it seriously. If you drove down Bourbon Street right now, you would just see empty sidewalks and boarded up bars. But, you know, Jeremy, as you mentioned, there have been exceptions. There's this pastor in Baton Rouge named Tony Spell who continues to hold these services with big numbers, hundreds of people, and has even said, if you can believe this, that the virus is politically motivated. You know, here in New Orleans, we've had police issue an arrest warrant for a band leader who organized a second line that was held over the weekend. But, you know, these are the exceptions. For the most part, New Orleans feels like a ghost town right now compared to last month.
Okay. And just to be clear, the virus is not politically motivated. It's affecting
countries all over the world.
Right. New Orleans does have a higher poverty rate than many other cities. It also has higher rates of pre-existing conditions like diabetes. How are those factors affecting the spread and the fatality rate, which is quite high?
That's one of the big questions right now. New Orleans, as you mentioned, has a high poverty rate, around 24%. And there are significant health disparities here that are apparently making the COVID-19 situation even more worrisome. For example, nearly 40% of people over 18 here have underlying health conditions like diabetes or high blood pressure that can lead to these severe outcomes with COVID-19. And, you know, just to compare, that rate's nearly double that of King County in Washington State, another hotspot. So there's a big concern that with these health disparities, the lack of access, the poverty rate, that's making the coronavirus situation here in New Orleans and Louisiana that much more severe.
One more thing. A lot of people look at the rates in Louisiana and say, oh, well, it's Mardi Gras because they did have the Mardi Gras celebrations. But the governor was asked on ABC this week about that, and he said he got no guidance not to have Mardi Gras from the federal government. Listen.
There was never any hint from anyone to me or to the mayor of New Orleans that there should be any consideration to downsizing or canceling Mardi Gras.
Just briefly, Patrick, how is the governor handling coordination with the federal government now?
Well, Governor Edwards says he's been reaching out to, you know, Trump. He's on these calls. But I'd say locally, it just feels like, you know, trying to blame New Orleans folks here for Mardi Gras, it feels like a blame shifting. At least that's the sentiment here when, you know, the lack of preparedness, you know, really falls on the shoulders of the federal government. Right. But it does feel like Mardi Gras was when it was the virus was first seeded here.
That is Patrick Madden in New Orleans. Let's go to Italy now. Very high death rate. And the BBC's Gene McKenzie joins us from Rome. Gene, are there signs that the steps Italy is taking to slow the spread are making a difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a really mixed week here, Jeremy, because throughout the week, we have had a real indication that the rate of infections is starting to slow down. But then at the same time, as you say, we've just had some horrendous days when we talk about the death rate. We had the highest death toll so far just a couple of days ago, more than 900 deaths in 24 hours. And we reached this terrible milestone over the weekend, which was 10,000 deaths now so far, expected to reach 11,000 today. So these numbers are just so high. But I was speaking to one of the public health experts here yesterday, and he was saying that, yes, while the deaths are so high, they are a snapshot of Italy 2 to 3 weeks ago in terms of the infections, because, of course, it takes time for somebody to contract the infection, show symptoms, and then it to play out. So they are saying that this doesn't mean that Italy's not making progress and that the effects of the lockdown, which has now been in place for 3 weeks, are starting to be seen. There's some suggestion that we might actually hit the peak here in terms of infections in the next few days.
The effects of the lockdown may be helping the public health situation, but there are now concerns about people acting out of desperation. There's a reporting about people organizing on Facebook in the south of Italy to steal from supermarkets. Are officials worried about social unrest there?
Yeah, the south of Italy is much poorer than the north, and people there are afraid. People are already running out of money. As you say, people have been locked in their houses now for 3 weeks, many of them unable to work, unable to earn. And that fear is playing out now on the streets in the south. Now, where I am in Rome and further in the north, people seem to be playing to the rules very strictly. People are afraid, afraid in so many different ways. I spoke to a man just the other day who his family hadn't left their flat for 18 days now, not even to go to the shops and to get food, some of them. And I was saying, you know, why? Why do you not want to take it in turns to go out or go out once a day? And I realized they're afraid. This virus is claiming so many lives here. When you turn on the news in the evening and you hear hundreds and hundreds more people have died, you cannot underestimate the impact that that is having on people and how that is playing out in different ways.
That is the BBC's Jean McKenzie speaking with us from Rome. Jean, thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Jeremy.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
So why are some people more vulnerable to COVID-19 than others? We're going to look at that question this week, starting today with cancer patients, about 650,000 of whom will have chemotherapy this year. So why do doctors feel that their chance of getting COVID-19 is as dangerous as the cancer itself? And how can they be made safer? And when are you safe around them? Well, listen up, because we have some important information now from oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee of Columbia University Medical Center. He's also the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Emperor of Maladies, a biography of cancer. So, Dr. Mukherjee, start with, you know, we know chemotherapy targets duplicating cancer cells, but you say it also targets good cells, you know, the ones that boost your immunity. It suppresses them.
Well, most cancer treatments will kill rapidly dividing cells, and your immune cells are among the most rapidly dividing. So you get immunosuppression as a consequence of chemotherapy. Not of all chemotherapies. There are certainly drugs that don't cause immunosuppression, but there are drugs that do cause immunosuppression, and those patients are particularly vulnerable to getting infected and potentially having more severe complications of their infections.
Right. So these white blood cells that we love because they are the body's best defense against viruses, they're suppressed. So normally people having these treatments are skittish about being around others. They don't want to catch anything. And now possibly they can get COVID-19. How are you handling cancer patients?
Well, we're trying our best to keep the guidelines and protocols and not delay treatment. Obviously, if we find that a patient has a concomitant infection of any kind, including possibly with COVID-19, we have to delay the treatment. There's, you know, whether it's COVID-19 or whether it's a bacterial pneumonia, giving more chemotherapy in the context of an infection is usually not recommended, except for unusual circumstances. We have advised as many people as possible that these patients are particularly susceptible and they should take extra care, including self-isolation, social distancing, and a lot of hand hygiene. The cornerstone of all of this is testing other patients, not chemotherapy patients, but testing the broad public to figure out who's infected and who's not infected. That is the cornerstone of being able to give safe chemotherapy to patients who are immunocompromised. Then the person who's infected knows that they should be in self-quarantine or in real quarantine, and the patients who are susceptible know as well. I think that if there's one thing that we need to do for cancer patients, if you have anyone in your family that is a cancer patient, try to isolate them, and for you yourself, stay at home and practice what the CDC and other agencies have been trying to tell you. Removing yourself away from a potentially infected pool is the best favor that you can do to a loved one who may be immunocompromised.
A couple things. You know, are there alternatives? Can you switch from the chemotherapy to, let's say, radiation? Is there anything else?
There are very few alternatives. I mean, in the sense that, you know, these are protocols that were devised based on very strong evidence. The number of doses, when the doses are given, and so forth. So there are certain aspects, and I would say rare aspects, of the delivery of cancer drugs where there can be changes made. Again, there are guidelines about how to make those changes. Number two, there's certain things in cancer which are not of immediate necessity. It's, again, rare. They're elective things that are done. We are delaying any and all of those. Just to give you a sense of the story and how complicated it is, there was a patient in one of our wards receiving chemotherapy for pancreatic cancer, sharing the ward with other patients. He was examined every day and nothing seemed, didn't have a fever, had nothing going on with him. One day, a surgical group came by and he coughed maybe a couple of times. And the surgeon said, gosh, you know, why don't we just test him just in case? This was 2 weeks ago before we knew so much about asymptomatic patients. And this patient was positive and was totally asymptomatic for the COVID-19 illness. So the patient was instantly isolated and removed from that room, etc. So without testing, we cannot easily tell whether you are at risk of transmitting the infection to your loved one. I mean, obviously, if you have symptoms, that's very clear. But if you don't have symptoms, you still may be shedding virus. We know this over and over again now from multiple studies.
Well, first, that poor man who, you know, inadvertently became kind of a Trojan horse, bringing the virus into that ward. You feel terrible for him. And we know that you're doing things like requesting that non-urgent patients use telemedicine. Some hospitals are having non-cancer patients use different elevators in different buildings where possible so they don't even cross tracks with the cancer patients that need this treatment. You've said that we have to test more and more people so we know who's positive, who's not. Until then, you know, we have to assume we all are positive. But I'm wondering, as you say that, you know, identify the people who are positive so people with cancer who are getting treatments can steer clear of them. What about the reverse of that? Should we also identify these, you know, these people struggling with cancer? Maybe they should have something on that says, I am getting cancer treatment. Please steer clear of me.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, there are complicated privacy issues involved. Cancer carries enough stigma in and of itself. Adding to that stigma, I think, will just really be a distasteful way to think about it.
Yeah. Some people are delaying treatment, but we don't know how long this pandemic will go on. And we are hearing from Dr. Fauci that it could come back next year. This could be lengthy.
We generally are recommending people not to delay treatment for cancer. There are windows beyond which delay of treatment actually can cause a problem. So we're generally trying to keep on track. In times of limited resources, we may not be able to keep on track. And that's why it's extraordinarily essential. I mean, people talk about, you know, the pandemic and the number of deaths that it's going to cause from COVID-19 infection. But there's also numbers of deaths that are going to be caused because of COVID-19 infection doesn't allow a patient with cancer to get an ICU bed when they need an ICU bed for some complication of cancer, not from COVID-19. Mm-hmm. So we're probably going to undercount the excess deaths caused by this epidemic because we're counting the deaths that are caused by COVID-19. We're not counting the deaths that are caused by the glomming up of hospital beds and ICU beds for people who really, really need treatment for other diseases such as cancer or heart disease. We recognize that virtually every single person listening to this probably has someone in their family, in their loved ones, in their friends who has cancer. Do them a favor, stay at home, and as has become a viral meme, flatten the curve, if not for yourself, then for your loved one who has cancer. There are two things that are really required. Number one, understanding who is actively shedding virus. So in other words, more testing. And also number two, what we haven't talked a lot about is that there are antibody tests which should be deployed and can be deployed quite easily, which tell you when you are post-immune from the virus, in which case you're safe.
In other words, you've had it, you fought it off, your body built up an immunity. In fact, there are trials now to maybe use those antibodies to, you know, fight the virus, but it indicates that you fought it up already, you have immunity to it.
That's correct. So it indicates that you've had immunity to it and you're not actively shedding the virus. If those two criteria are met, then you are actually safe. If we could get these two pieces together, and these are not complicated things to do, and give healthcare workers access to these tests, again, we would save a lot of lives and a lot of money, because those people, let's say you're a chemo nurse, and you know that you've been exposed, you're no longer shedding virus, you've acquired memory immunity, then you are a perfect candidate to return back to work and to be able to give safely chemotherapy to a patient who may be immunocompromised because you are not actively contagious. But we now need to start measuring within people. Make tests widely available outside dangerous areas like hospitals where you don't want potentially COVID-infected patients to come in and test. But, you know, drive-through testing, tent-based testing, testing in places where you can be safe and you can keep others safe as well.
And you get a general sense of the whole community, not just people in a hospital.
Exactly. We aren't going to solve the economic problems without solving the medical problems first. Most of these techniques are decades old. They just need to be deployed properly so that we can get maybe 50, 60% of the population back to work.
That is oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee from Columbia University's Irving Cancer Center. He's also the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Emperor of Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. Doctor, thank you so much. I'm assuming the bottom line is that you want patients to talk to their care team and make their own decisions, but with all of this in mind.
That is correct.
Doctor, thanks so much. Best of luck to you.
Best of luck to you. Thank you so much.
There are more coronavirus cases here in the U.S. now than any country in the world. But to the south in Mexico, the outbreak is nowhere near as bad, at least not yet. Joining us now from Mexico City is NPR's Carrie Kahn. Carrie, first of all, tell us more about the situation there. Is the number of infections in Mexico accelerating?
It is. In the last couple of days, it has been growing quite quickly and doubling days, but we're still in the hundreds. I think it's just about the 1,000 mark. And that's because health officials here tell us that we are about a month behind where the United States is, that the first case that was confirmed here of COVID-19 was in late February, whereas the first case in the United States was late January. So they say we're about a month behind y'all.
Well, and many people in the U.S., experts in the U.S. would say that they wish that the U.S. had started acting sooner than it did. How is the president of Mexico, Lopez Obrador, responding to the crisis now, given that, as you said, you're a month behind the U.S.?
That's a great, great question. And it's something that's being debated heavily here because it wasn't until last Monday, a week ago, that they put into effect the social distancing measures. And they're not mandatory. They're suggested. And you can see the unequal application of it throughout the country. There are some states and cities that are taking it much more seriously than other places, like in the state of Yucatan, which is up in the Caribbean. There, the governor there said if people don't do social distancing, if they are found to be positive with the COVID-19 and are out in the streets or have infected other people, he's talking about a sentence of 3 years in jail, where all in other places, I was out in Mexico City over the weekend riding my bike in one of the biggest parks, our Central Park here, and there were people out in the streets. There were cars everywhere down in the historic center where the main administrative office is, and it's beautiful, the historic part of Mexico City. There's artists, performers out there. There's crowds. You see people out, protesters, everything. So it's really a mixed bag of how people are taking the social distancing right now.
Kerry, in his news conference the other day, President Trump said that he wanted to thank the president of Mexico for having done such a great job with respect to the military. Quote, we have 27,000 Mexican soldiers on our southern border and very few people are getting through. I can tell you that. And we've got to keep it that way. That was President Trump talking. How has this crisis impacted the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico?
Well, I think what's interesting right now is where you're seeing this land border that we share, and that there are far more cases in the United States than in Mexico. And Mexico has been very hesitant to take any measures to prohibit Americans from coming into Mexico. But as the cases are growing in the United States, Mexico, some cities along the border have been taking stronger measures. But I was just reading in the newspaper this morning that if you look at certain cities across the border, northern Mexican border cities, they aren't taking a lot of measures still guarding against Americans coming in. At one crossing, which is very busy, Ciudad Juarez and El Paso, Texas, there were a few Mexican agents out there that were handing out pamphlets about how to protect yourself from the virus. And so that is something that is upsetting a lot of people in Mexico. They're worried about the importation of more cases from Americans. But, you know, you can still book a flight from the United States to Mexico. Their airports are not closed here.
That is NPR's Kerry Conn in Mexico City. Kerry, thanks.
You're welcome.
The biotech company Gilead Sciences said over the weekend it will expand access to its experimental treatment for COVID-19, remdesivir. Now, this isn't the anti-malaria drug chloroquine, which President Trump has praised, but only today was okayed by the FDA for possible emergency use in a White House plan. Remdesivir is an antiviral. There are hopes it can be effective. Rear Admiral Richard Childs is Assistant Surgeon General and a lung specialist at the National Institutes of Health. He has firsthand knowledge of remdesivir and a caution. He led that team sent to Japan to screen Americans on that Diamond Princess cruise ship. Admiral Childs, what happened?
So the first part of that mission went relatively smoothly, but what came as a surprise was we learned there were a substantial number of sick Americans with COVID-19 hospitalized throughout Japan, 51 to be exact. 14 of those 51 Americans had become critically ill from the virus. They had an average age of 75 years, and they all had severe pneumonia and were in intensive care units, including 10 who were on mechanical ventilators and 4 who were on ECMO machines, which is basically a heart-lung bypass machine. And looking at those first x-rays, it just hit you that, wow, this is something different. This is a very, very severe virus that can cause incredible morbidity and mortality.
Well, and we're reading that what was happening in Japan is that the doctors there were also scurrying to get ahead of this new deadly virus. And then there was this thought of getting remdesivir. You, at this point, set up a war room, we're reading, in the U.S. Embassy. You're studying x-rays. You're now getting down to the business of what do we do for these Americans. And some remdesivir was ordered. What is this drug?
So remdesivir is an antiviral agent. It's been around for a while. It's not yet approved. It's been tested against a variety of different viruses, including viruses in the corona family. And the drug has good activity in the laboratory against corona-type viruses. So it interferes with the ability of the RNA virus to reproduce itself, interfering with the total number of viral particles that can invade different organs, particularly the lung.
So there are patients that qualify for remdesivir because of their, you know, medical history. You and the Japanese doctors start giving this intravenously once a day for 10 days. We understand now all 7 patients who received remdesivir are alive. That doesn't prove, and I think you'd be the first to say this, that remdesivir, you know, works in treatment for COVID-19. So what are you taking away from this?
Well, you're exactly right. While those that receive remdesivir and the cohort that were treated in Japan were amongst the sickest, and none of them are any longer critically ill. It's really impossible to say with any certainty what role this drug played in their recovery. In the end, the goal is with these drugs to buy time for the immune system to kick in. So if you can keep patients with the most severe coronavirus pneumonia alive long enough with ventilators, or as the Japanese have demonstrated with ECMO, sooner or later, the immune system is going to figure this thing out and will eradicate the virus. So what we learned was that you have to be incredibly aggressive with providing supportive care that's focused on the lungs. They would identify patients that had a certain degree of lung involvement, and they would move them from maybe a community hospital to a more advanced hospital that would have the ability to support them on mechanical ventilation. And then those patients that were on mechanical ventilation, when they look like their lungs were so severe that they would die on the ventilator, they would move them to their tertiary medical centers that had ECMO in anticipation that they might need that sort of penultimate level of life support.
Well, so to be clear about what you're saying is, you know, get critically ill people right onto the machines that can help those lungs. But what should happen now, Admiral? Because we have Gilead Sciences saying we've been overwhelmed with orders. We've got people self-treating with chloroquine, which is the other drug that may also buy time in the treatment of COVID-19. And the man who self-treated died. So what do you think the best fix right now would be?
I think that there's certainly a sense of desperation. And I think that's why we're seeing people jumping to conclusions about what may or may not be helpful. Unfortunately, when we start to make these assumptions based on anecdotal experiences that, you know, Mr. Jones got the drug and Mr. Jones got better, and then we say, based on that experience of one or two or maybe 10 or 20, in the context that, you know, 10 or 20 very well just with nothing may survive. If we make that assumption incorrectly, then we are giving something to a person that may not be helping them, could potentially harm them, and could be harmful in the sense that it prevents them from getting the real effective therapy. So better that we do these randomized trials with multiple different agents so that we can say clearly, okay, this drug looks like, you know, it improves survival. That's a candidate to become potentially a standard. If we just base all of our treatments on anecdotal evidence, there's a real, you know, possibility that several months from now, we may be treating patients incorrectly.
Rear Admiral Richard Childs, Assistant Surgeon General and Lung Specialist at the National Institutes of Health. Admiral Childs, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the coronavirus pandemic has crushed economies around the world and sent some commodity prices spiraling. As Texas Standard's Michael Marks reports, the disease injected the cattle market with a big dose of uncertainty at just the wrong time.
Billy Schwertner has never done anything but work with cattle.
All my life. That's all I've ever done.
Which, at 74 years old, saying something. Schwertner grazes 450 cattle on a 3,000-acre ranch northwest of Houston. He also owns and operates three livestock auctions. The weekly sales connect ranchers to feedlots and big meatpacking companies. They're a key link in the chain that runs from a pasture to your plate, and they're still open, since agriculture is considered critical infrastructure. But when concerns about the virus started, his fellow ranchers still had a lot of questions about how it would affect them.
Last Tuesday, my cell phone alone, not my office phone, my cell phone alone, I took 98 calls.
Even as grocery shoppers picked meat coolers clean, fear and uncertainty around the coronavirus caused cattle prices to tank. They dropped about 20% from the end of February through the middle of March. Ranchers wanted Schwertner's opinion on what would happen to the beef market, whether they should sell cows or hold on to them. His response?
I hate to give him the wrong answer. My famous comment is, I can tell you what happened yesterday, but I haven't got a clue what's going to happen tomorrow.
No one does, and that's the problem. Although cattle prices rallied some earlier this month, no one really knows what beef demand will look like for the foreseeable future. Sure, grocery stores are selling out of hamburger, but what about restaurants? Will people still be buying fillets or just tri-tip? And is all this going to change in a month? In a week?
This is a real wreck for producers. It's a disaster.
That's David Anderson. He is a professor of agricultural economics at Texas A&M University. He says making prudent decisions is hard with so much volatility, and it could not have come at a worse time. See, cattle production is cyclical. It dropped during a major drought in 2011. Since then, ranchers have been expanding their herds. By 2019,
we got to sort of our peak cow herd nationwide.
And supply is still really high. So right as a huge number of cows are ready to be sold and turned into beef, boom, coronavirus. Uncertainty clouds the market. Cattle producers are left in the lurch. The shock was so significant that some auction owners canceled their weekly sale because they just weren't sure if they'd have enough cows to make it worth their while. But Billy Schwertner will stay open as long as he's allowed to.
The producer needs to sell the animal to create cash flow. We need to have a sale to pay our bills and all that kind of stuff. And then our employees and, you know, keep all of them going. Then it's also that food chain.
Long term, the good news for ranchers is that at least feed costs are expected to be low this year. There will likely be fewer calves born this spring than last, which could help prices come up. But Anderson, the economist, said in the short term, there aren't a lot of reasons to be optimistic.
There are some supportive things in the market, depending on what happens in the next 6 months. You know, the uncertainty is how long does this last and how deep and severe does it get?
For Here and Now, I'm Michael Marks.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
One thing we're getting used to as we follow coronavirus developments is a lot of numbers. The number of cases, the death toll, the number of people filing for unemployment, and on and on. But what are the numbers telling us? Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from Washington as he does each Monday. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
So you compare the haze of uncertainty that we're in right now and all these numbers with the fog of war. Explain what you mean by that.
So the fog of war is a relatively common term that's used to describe the fact that when a country is fighting a war, it often doesn't know what the heck is going on. It refers to the idea that was once coined by the 19th century Prussian military writer Karl von Clausewitz, that militaries don't understand two things. They don't understand the enemy's threat, and they don't understand their own capacity to combat the enemy. And what I said in this article is that we're experiencing now the fog of pandemic. We are swimming in statistics, infection rates, case fatality ratios, economic data. I mean, turn on the radio, turn on your TV, log online, and you are going to see information and statistics galore. But what I wanted to point out is that all of these statistics are flawed in some way, and it is misleading and sometimes even dangerous to draw too strong conclusions from information that is deeply flawed.
Flawed because, for example, in the case of testing and how many people have the virus, we don't actually test everyone, and so therefore we don't know? Or is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so I'll give you two examples from public health to start. So first, you look at the international data. There have, for a few weeks, been concerns that the data coming out of China isn't particularly trustworthy. But really, it's just about all the international data. It was just reported that France and Italy haven't typically been including home deaths in their COVID statistics. So all these graphs that we see comparing U.S. death totals to Europe and to China, you know, maybe you should, you know, put a big asterisk over all those numbers because it's not clear that any particular countries are using the exact same methodology to count COVID deaths. Then you look at the national data. You know, our testing capacity is ramping up really quickly, and that's a great thing. But it's ramping up from a really low number, and it's very uneven across the country. You know, the South, California, New York all have very different standards, very different density of tests, different shares of the population that are being tested. And that means that when you're looking at these all-important graph numbers, it's hard to disentangle how much of this is the disease spreading exponentially versus how much of it is the testing increasing exponentially. We just don't quite know yet.
And what about when it comes to the economic numbers? We got that jobless claims report last week that said more than 3 million people had filed for unemployment. Economists are expecting that to go higher. We're going to get the monthly employment report this Friday. Is that going to give us a good sense of what's going on economically?
No, it's really not going to give us a good sense. And it's not the government's fault. It's not the fault of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. You know, the Bureau has this very specific methodology where they do these surveys the week of the 12th of the month. So we're going to get an estimate of the unemployment rate from the week of March 12th. Well, March 12th was the Thursday before many states and cities announced on the following Sunday that they'd be closing all these restaurants and bars. So the unemployment rate that we're going to get this Friday is a measurement of the first 2 weeks of March. But it won't provide an accurate picture of, say, March 29th, March 30th, which is really what economists want to know about. How weak, how strong is the economy right now? And this is really important because one of the critical questions that we have to answer is, how long do we have to live like this? How long do we have to live in self-quarantine? You know, we need good information, good data to understand when we can break this abnormal situation and begin to return to normal. But until we have great data, it will always be very risky to determine when exactly we can break social isolation.
Well, and I think that's what makes this situation even scarier is the uncertainty around it, certainly how long it's going to last, how bad it is going to get, and will we ever be able to go back to what we had before, or is it just going to be something new that we don't know about? What do you think, Derek, will bring this outbreak into better focus?
You know, I've been talking to a lot of economists and public health experts about what is a statistic that would really tell us that our public health capacity is improving in its ability to treat people who have become sick. And one thing they suggested, and this is sort of creative and clever, is what about a survey of frontline healthcare workers in hospitals so that they could essentially tell us, all right, we're beginning to see the curve bend here in front of us. We're seeing fewer cases in New York City or in St. Louis or in Miami, that some kind of survey of healthcare workers might be able to tell us when our capacity to treat people is increasing. And that's where we might be able to see, okay, now we have some indication that the curve is bending and we can look potentially to releasing some people from social isolation and relaxing some of the constraints in the economy that are really important to have right now, but dangerous to enforce over the period of, say, 9 or 12 consecutive months.
That is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.